is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I'm not qualified to debate the science over climate change.
I'm not a scientist.
What I have said repeatedly is I'm not a scientist.
Yes, everyone who denies man-made climate change has the same stirring message. We don't know what the f*** we're talking about.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
Good afternoon. This is the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw with you. And it is a pleasure in our first segment today to welcome a former NASCAR driver and racing analyst. And just truly, this man has energy in his blood, in his family blood as well. Mr. Kyle Petty. He is leading the 29th annual Kyle Petty Charity Ride Across America. This year, there will be 225 riders, we're told, covering over 1,400 miles, and all of that in 7 days. And this is designed to raise money and awareness for Victory Junction, a camp that we're going to learn more about in just a little bit. The ride kicks off in Traverse City, comes through Michigan, and we're super excited because it's making a stop right here in Dearborn. So Kyle's joining us to talk about the ride and how you can get involved as well. Kyle, first of all, welcome to WHFR. It's just a pleasure to have you.
Thank you guys for having me.
We know that you have had an incredible career in racing in NASCAR, and now 3 decades almost leading this charity ride. What inspired you to turn your love of riding into this mission that's helping so many children?
So if I have to be totally honest with you, there was a group of us, myself, Harry Gant, who drove a race car, Mike Helton at NASCAR. There were just a number of us. We really just wanted to ride motorcycles from California to North Carolina. After the race was over, and we told everybody what our plan was, and they told us we were idiots. They were like, no, that's not never going to happen. So we got back together and we talked about it, and we said, we decided we would do it for charity, that we would stop and give some money away in each city that we traveled through for charity. And we told everybody about it, and they were like, oh my gosh, that's the greatest idea we have ever heard. So really, it was a little selfish that first year, because we wanted to ride motorcycles. We gave money away for charity, and it evolved into stopping at different children's hospitals, from Mattel UCLA Medical Center to Children's Mercy in Kansas City to Emory University in Atlanta to a million Shriners hospitals. It feels like we went to every Shriners hospital. But anyhow, that's what it was. And then in 2000, my oldest son, Adam, was killed in a racing accident in New Hampshire. And I had driven some sports car races with Paul Newman. And we had talked about a camp Adam and I had, and it was his dream and his vision. And that's the first thing that popped into our mind. We're going to build a camp. So we came back, built a camp. And since that moment in 2000, when Adam's accident happened, every dime that we raise goes to send more and more kids to camp.
Mm. And what a feeling that must be to honor his legacy and his dreams as well through this and through so many children making a difference in their lives and, of course, the lives of their families. Tell us a little bit about Victory Junction, the story behind it, as you just shared, sort of for its inception. But paint the picture of what that experience looks like for kids that have serious medical conditions and just giving them a chance to just be normal kids.
That's right. That is it right there. Just be kids. That's it. We don't cure their illness. We hopefully alleviate the worry and the pain for a week. We just empower them to be the kids they are. Most of these children, when they go to school, they're known as, oh, that's the little boy in the wheelchair, or that's the little girl that walks with a walker because she has juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, or that's the little boy with Crohn's. They're known by their disease. when they come to camp with a serious illness or a life-threatening disease or a chronic illness, they're known as Tommy. They're known as Julie. They're known as Russ. They're known by their names. And that's something almost new to a lot of these kids. They meet people. It's fascinating to me. We do horseback riding. We do a ropes course. We have a swimming pool. We have a swimming pool, an aquatic swimming pool that children in wheelchairs who have never been free to roam in a swimming pool, they just roll off into the swimming pool in an aquatic wheelchair. They can leave their wheelchair and come back to it at any point in time. It sits on the bottom of the pool, which is fascinating to me when you watch these kids. Everything that children do at a regular camp, they can do here. It's just under medical supervision. We'll have as many as 5 or 6 doctors on staff during the summer, as many as 40 or 50 nurses. The volunteer rate or adult rate to children are 2 adults for every 1 child that's on campus at that time. It's a hospital really disguised as a camp. That's what we tell people. It's a hospital disguised as a camp. And I tell this story. When I was racing, I brought this little boy across stage with me, and he had a very visual illness and an affliction and very visual. You could see it. And he waved to the crowd and everybody was happy and it was all fun and games because we're doing a driver introduction. And Monday after that, we got a call from a family in Ohio that said, could you connect us to that little boy? And of course we couldn't because of HIPAA, because of so many things. But we told the parents of this little boy and he called the family in Ohio. The family in Ohio had a little boy the exact same age. The little boy in Ohio had never seen another child that looked like he did until he turned on the TV and saw this little boy come across stage with me. They became best friends for about 10 years. They vacationed together during the summertime. They went to college together. And as far as I know, they're still friends. That's what camp is all about. In a nutshell, if camp does nothing more than connect those two little boys in 40 years, it's still been a huge success.
Oh, that's a great story. Thank you for sharing it. We're talking today with a legendary race car driver, announcer, and truly a philanthropist extraordinaire, Kyle Petty, talking about the exciting event coming up, which is the Charity Ride Across America, which is literally right around the corner. I mean, it's kicking off next week. And tell us a little bit, Kyle, about this year's event. I understand you're calling it the Tour of Wonders, and that sounds quite fascinating. And we get it here in Michigan because we love our wonderland of great weather. And we look one way and you've got green. You look the other way, you've got blue waters and so on and everything in between. But why this grouping of locales? And tell us about the Tour of Wonders.
So here's what we decided. So every year after the ride, we send out a questionnaire and say, how'd you like the ride? How'd you like the food? How'd you like the hotels? And at the bottom, it's always like, where would you like to go back to? What would you like to see? And so many times, the number one answer is we want to see things we've ridden by for 20 years. You know what I mean? Because we just passed things for 20 years. We just blasted by everything. And that was like the number one answer always. It's in the top 2 or 3 anyhow. We ask them where they want to start from. Traverse City, we were in Traverse City a number of years ago, and we just loved Traverse City. It was just a great place. The people were nice. The resort was nice. Everything was nice. So that was a thing. And Niagara Falls was another thing that people wanted to see. So as we sat down and started looking at it, I included some of my favorite places. So we're going to leave Traverse City, and we're coming to Detroit, to Dearborn, to the Henry Ford Museum. This is my favorite place in the world. When I was a little boy in the late 60s, early 70s, and my dad raced at MIS, my mom would take us to the Henry Ford Museum, and we would spend a day there. And we did this for years, from the time I was 15 or 16 years old. I know we went 5 or 6 years in a row, just through the early 70s, and it was just an amazing place. So we're coming to the Henry Ford Museum. Then we're going to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because I love music. So we're going to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Then we're going up to Niagara Falls. Then we're going over to Corning, New York, to the Corning Museum of Glass and to Watkins Glen. You got to throw a racetrack in it. If you drove a race car sometime in your life, you got to throw a race car. Then we're coming back down to Bedford Springs and we're staying at the Omni Hotel. This is a hotel that's set for almost 40 years, I think, with no one in it. They've restored it. They've had 16 different presidents that have stayed at this hotel. Then we end in Hot Springs. In Hot Springs, the homestead at Hot Springs, another Omni resort, has had 26 presidents who have spent a night and stayed there. So we looked at it and we were like, man, you know, everything that's in the Henry Ford Museum is just a wonder. When you walk through there and you see the cars and you see the American history, not only the automotive, but you see the American history and you see Deerfield Village, you see all of this stuff. There's so many, much cool stuff. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, man, you get to see the actual paper that Bruce Springsteen wrote on, that so many great artists wrote on. You go to Niagara Falls and that. In one end of the country, you've got the Grand Canyon, a big hole in the ground. And on the other end of the country, you've got water spilling over that could fill it up. So that's pretty cool. Then we're going to the Museum of Glass. I love glass and love glass blowing and the art part of that. And then down to, as I said, to Bedford Springs and then on to the other place. So these were just wonderful places and wonders as far as I was concerned. So that's why we came up with the name.
Well, that's just a perfect name, and we completely agree with everything you've just said, especially about the Henry Ford Museum. As we know here in Dearborn, you know, our namesake at Henry Ford College, actually, college and community radio station, WHFR. And Kyle, we're so excited that this group is coming through. I have seen, you know, just driving up north or something, groups of maybe, you know, 15 motorcycles together, 20 motorcycles together, but I truly can't imagine 125 all kind of coming down the road together. That's just got to be awe-inspiring. How can we experience that? How does that part work? And where can we find you, you know, here in our community?
Yes.
On that Sunday?
Yeah, so here's the thing. So we are, if you will go to our website, KylePettyCharityRide.com, you'll see our times when we're leaving the hotels, when we're arriving at the hotels, when we're stopping for fuel stops. There's different places along the route that we'll stop for an hour, hour and a half, have lunch, have a fuel stop in different cities. And we invite everybody to come out. See my dad, Richard Petty, will be with us. Herschel McGriff, another NASCAR Hall of Famer, will be with us. Herschel Walker, NFL superstar, Heisman Trophy winner, he'll be with us. Kenny Wallace, Kenny Schrader, Rutledge Wood from Top Gear America. We'll have a few celebrities. But we just ask people to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, X, or any other social media platform that develops between now and the time we start the ride, because it seems like a social media platform pops up every week or so. So follow us wherever you can. We'll tell you where we're going to be, and we ask you to just come out, shake our hand, say hello, just hang out with us, man, take a picture, whatever. That's the cool part. I tell people, and we go back to the Tour of Wonders, the things we see are so exciting, but the people we meet along the way are the people we'll tell stories about in 10 or 15 years. You know, I met a guy in Dearborn at the Henry Ford, and he had this, or he did that, or he built this, or whatever it may be. Those are the stories you tell.
Yeah. And again, in our area, Sunday, May 4th. So literally just next weekend. So we wanted to give our listeners a week's notice so that you could literally plan around this event, because I think you're going to want to. I understand, Kyle, that, in your 29th year, just throwing out some numbers, over $22 million raised through this event for children's charities, including Victory Junction. What does it mean to you to see something that sort of started in such a personal way grow to such a powerful, truly, a national cause?
So it's two things. Number one, it's just incredibly humbling. And I am humbled by the people that ride with me. I'm humbled by the people that come out and say, you know, here's a $5, $5 bill. Send the kid to camp. Here's some loose change. Can you put it in a bucket and send some kids to camp? And I am humbled by that. At the same time, it's inspirational to be on this ride and see the good in people, to see the good in this country. When you stop at a gas station and there's 100, 150 people, and they just come out just because they know that this ride is helping kids. All we did was raise our hand and say, hey, we're going to ride motorcycles and we're going to send some kids to camp. And then other people come out and say, hey, I want to be a part of that. Here's $5. Here's $10. Here's a prayer for you. Here's a pat on the back for you, whatever that may be. You know, it's just we ask for encouragement. We ask for anything. But at the same time, we live in a great country and we have an opportunity to do good. And when you have an opportunity to do good, no matter who you are, if you'll just raise your hand and turn around and look over your shoulder, there'll be somebody following you. There'll be somebody following you because you're doing good. And that's that's what this ride has been about for me.
Yeah. Well, we thank you for continuing to sit in the driver's seat for this one. And it really is so exciting having all of these other people that are, I'm sure, colleagues and comrades and friends, as well as those maybe from different areas saying, I'm available that time, you know, this year. I can pop in. That's got to be pretty exciting, I would think. Although, you know, you have so many adoring fans. You've got to be fans of some of these people that you get to sort of rub elbows with on the bikes as well, huh?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You know, we've got a gentleman named Lynn Sherrill. Lynn Sherrill, when we started the ride, Lynn Sherrill went on the ride with us that very first year because he knew about motorcycles. And I knew some motorcycles were going to break down. And he said, I can fix them. And here we are 29 years later, and he's still on the motorcycle ride. He used to work on my race car. We have people that run multi-million-dollar businesses that come on this ride, and everybody just gets along. It is the funniest thing. I tell people all the time, we ride together for a week and then leave and come back a year later and just pick up the conversation on where we're at. These people that ride, they're the superstars. They're the ones that I'm humbled by the fact that they come out and ride with us. And then when you see campers along the way, we've seen campers from all 50 states, from six foreign countries, I think. And we'll have campers and their families that come out and see us. And when they come out, listen, you could be standing in 30 degree weather pouring down rain. And when a camper comes up to you and says, hey, thank you for helping me go to camp, it makes every bit of it worthwhile.
Yeah. My sister Sally is probably your biggest fan. I'm just going to throw that out there. But I know, again, you've got so many others, as well as just all of these people involved. And then there's the side of the people that are the fans of the camp, right, of Victory
Yes.
Junction, and the support that I'm sure they share it for all of this, you know, to raise these funds for this event. You mentioned, you know, even, you know, Paul Newman from years back, who was instrumental, and we know, and his legacy still lives on as well. So you're absolutely right when you say about the good, you know, looking for the good in the world.
Yes.
And looking for the good in your fellow human beings. And we've just got an awful lot of them, at least, you know, at least 200 and probably being a part of the ride. When we talk about 125 motorcycles, and I know you're going to ride through the entire 1400 or so mile route, just a technical question. Do people switch up their bikes, or do you stay on the same one the whole time, or, you know, how does that work? And what are you riding? I'm sure our listeners want to know.
So I ride a Harley. I ride a Harley. Listen, I tell people this, my man, Harry Gant, who used to drive a race car. He said, if you own a sports car, it has to be a Corvette and it has to be red. If you own a luxury car, it has to be a Cadillac and it has to be white. If you own a pickup, okay, it has to be a Ford, and it has to be white also, according to Harry. But if you ride a motorcycle, it's got to be a Harley. Doesn't make any difference what color it is. It's just got to be a Harley. So I live by that maxim right there. So I ride a Harley. I ride a Road Glide. Everybody pretty much stays on the same bike, unless you break down, and we carry some extra bikes so that if you break down along the way, we just load your bike up, put you on another bike so you can finish the day, and then we'll work on your bike that night in the parking lot. That's kind of the way it works. So, but listen, Harleys never break down. You know that they're like Fords. They never break down, man. That's the way it is. So it's pretty good, but we do have extra bikes.
All right. Well, it sounds fascinating. Can't wait to see it. Again, the ride date's May 3rd through the 9th. So it is coming up, starting in Traverse City, working its way down into the Detroit Dearborn area on the 5th, on that Sunday, and then all the way over, wrapping up in Hot Springs, Virginia. Well, I trust the weather will be just perfect. And, again, rain or shine, this takes place. Yes.
Yeah. Rain or shine. It doesn't make any difference. We've ridden through sleet. We've ridden through snow. We had to park one time and take shelter out in Kansas when a tornado kind of came out of nowhere. That's about the only time we've ever stopped for any length of time. I will say that, but we continue to ride. We're back on the road, and I guess that's what crazy people do when you ride motorcycles, man. You gotta live with the elements. But we're coming up north. It's going to be perfect. 60 degrees, 65, something like that. No humidity. It's not like down here in the South where it's already 85 with 110% humidity and you're sweating sitting in your living room. We're looking forward to coming north.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're looking forward to having you. Kyle Petty joining us here on WHFR, Charity Ride Across America. If you'd like to learn more, follow along, make a donation, you can visit KylePettyCharityRide.com or VictoryJunction.org. And if you're near the route, especially here in Southeast Michigan, be sure to stop by, show your support, and really cheer on these riders. They are making every mile count, and it's just for such a wonderful cause. So, Kyle Petty, thank you for your time today. Great success, and we're looking forward to hearing all the great things that have been that have come out of the 2025 Charity Ride.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. A pleasure. This is the WHFR Journal. In our next segment, we are going to air for you the ceremony that took place on the 17th of April, right here on Henry Ford College's campus, a ceremony to honor and showcase the recipients of the Barrett Creative Writing Awards.
Good afternoon. My name is Summer Starrood. I'm the chair of the Francis G. Barrett and Larry Coulter Creative Writing Prize. I also teach English. I want to thank you all for coming today to this year's Barrett Coulter Creative Writing Awards ceremony. It is sincerely one of my favorite events since I've joined Henry Ford College, and it's just a real privilege to get to be a part of it. This year is extra special and exciting because, in case you didn't notice, it's Barrett's, the award's 50th I was saying anniversary, but we've got birthday stuff, so Barrett is 50, and given that I've only been here for 4 years, it feels kind of wrong that I'm the first one to publicly wish this award a happy birthday, but I'm honored to do it. I want to thank our former chair, John Reitz, for his support throughout this. Yes. Always running to him with questions. Also, our other committee members, Peter Kim, Maggie Rutkowski, Jessica Schamberger, Ruth Ann Schmidt, and Angela Hathikanavala. It's a tradition to lead the ceremony with a poem. So I wanted to read a poem that expresses one of the themes, at least in my opinion, of the Barrett Coulter Award, which is that even if you are afraid, it is often better to speak. This poem is by Audre Lorde. It's called A Litany for Survival. A Litany for Survival. For those of us who live at the shoreline, standing upon the constant edges of decision, crucial and alone, for those of us who cannot indulge the passing dreams of choice, who love in doorways coming and going, in the hours between dawns looking inward and outward, at once before and after, seeking a now that can breed futures like bread in our children's mouths, so their dreams will not reflect the death of ours. For those of us who were imprinted with fear, like a faint line in the center of our foreheads, learning to be afraid with our mother's milk, for by this weapon, this illusion of some safety to be found, the heavy-footed hoped to silence us. For all of us, this instant and this triumph, we were never meant to survive. And when the sun rises, we are afraid it might not remain. When the sun sets, we are afraid it might not rise in the morning. When our stomachs are full, we are afraid of indigestion. When our stomachs are empty, we are afraid we may never eat again. When we are loved, we are afraid love will vanish. When we are alone, we are afraid love will never return. And when we speak, we are afraid our words will not be heard nor welcome. But when we are silent, we are still afraid. So it is better to speak, remembering we were never meant to survive. I'm so glad this year's winners have chosen to speak by submitting their work to the Barrett Committee. It's a vulnerable thing to do, and we thank you. We also thank all of those who submitted work this year. It's such a joy to read so many compelling student writers' work. It's very heartening. If the winners could please come up, I will introduce them to you and give your certificates. Come on up. In fifth place, we have Furkan Hassan. Our fourth place winner is Emily Shiroda. Our third is Miriam Sofian. Second place is Alana DiMaggio. And our first place winner for the Barrett is Elena Schnell. Each year, the Barrett also awards the Larry Coulter Prize in Poetry for the best poetry submission, and this honor also goes to Elena Schnell. 2 years in a row, like a sweep. Congratulations. I'm gonna ask Ruth Ann to come up and introduce our fifth place winner.
Hi, I'm Ruth Ann Schmidt. I'm an English instructor at HFC. It is my great pleasure to introduce Farquan Hassan, our fifth place winner, and a chemical engineering major. Farquan, like all future great chemical engineers, has a deep love of poetry. And like all great chemical engineer poets, he idolizes Robert Frost. He came to the United States with his family, who lives in Michigan, only a few years ago from Kahar, where in the second grade, he wrote a tiny acrostic poem about snakes in English, one of his three languages. And this got him some attention from the teachers, who also compared him to a young Robert Frost. But for many years after, this future chemical engineer's interest in poetry was quiet until he met a girl. He was traveling with a Pakistani military family from his hometown of Kalar, passing the salt mines, past the holy temples, traveling from this mountaintop to that one, when he met this girl. She was also traveling with her military family, and their paths continued to cross and uncross until they met at a nondisclosed city in Pakistan, and a relationship bloomed. And they began hiding love letters for each other in the local library, giving each other teasing hints about which book they were in and where to find them. Farquan will read two selections, one of which is Matriarch's Murmur, which is about the early moments of this relationship and is filled with light and admiration. The second is Brushed with Anxiety, which is a portrait of a woman riddled with anxiety. It marks the end of their time together. This poem was written with great care and tucked in a library book in a hustling, bustling, non-disclosed city in Pakistan in the hopes that she would find it. It was written for her. Please listen for the rhythms that come together and shyly fall away. This is a little like poetry of Robert Frost, but also like the poetry of the future great chemical engineer poets, and that it celebrates inner beauty and character, all the things bonding and holding us together that then allow us to fall apart.
Thank you, Anne Schmidt. The first poem is Matriarch's Murmur. So there's a lot of feminine energy in this poem, I hope so. She rose in the valley of nothingness, a petal of hope she grew to be. She established her roots in the most dry of places and forced the rainfall there to be. She grew slow, but she grew strong, correcting along the way all that was wrong. In her domain there's shelter too, but only if you be real and be the original you. The next poem is Brushed by Anxiety. I think this is the one which got the attention of the judges, I guess. Brushed by Anxiety. Blots of ink all over her white dress. She rests the palette gently. Her imaginative pattern is a mess. She empties the cigarette case, squinting her lips. Left hand high on muscle memory, she grips the lighter. Sun caressing her spine, she consciously exhales. To test if the freshly thought hypothesis prevails, that the denser the smoke, the sadder the heart. She rapidly loses interest in the result. Maybe an episode of absurdism struck her. maybe a counteracting thought made a flutter. What difference would it make? What would it do? With that, her neurons detach from the nicotine residue. She flicks the cigarette, grabs the brush. To not lose the context, she seems to rush. Stares at the canvas hostility she finds. Puts a fresh canvas on. The conundrum of unfinished paintings goes on. Thank you.
That did catch our eye. We are an anxious bunch in the English, in the Barrett Committee. I didn't remember, I forgot to thank Paul and Walter, who are not even here now to receive thanks, but I don't think, right? But all the tech stuff was made possible and some of the equipment. And so thank you to them. Our fourth place winner, Emily Shiroda, is just 16 years old. Yeah. This is an extraordinary accomplishment at such a young age, but it is not surprising considering she began taking college classes at just 14. Her poetry confronts the quiet battles women face with fierce honesty and hope. As she writes, quote, "Together women rise from the ashes of their struggles, their hearts intertwine, her soul mends the shattered pieces of another." Influenced by feminist voices like Ruby Carr and the strength of her sister, her own sister Jessica, Emily's openness of her heart spans generations. She dreams of becoming a NICU nurse, loves children, and also cherishes Thursdays spent watching Judge Judy with her grandmother, calling it the best therapy ever. Her words echo with empathy, conviction, and the belief that, quote, "We can do anything as long as we never, not even for one second, give up on what we want this life to be." Please help me congratulate Emily.
This is Surrender to Society. Late at night, when the flower wilts the most, you lie awake thinking, no, dreaming, about a world where everyone sees you for who you truly are, a woman. Young women are forced to follow rules that are meant to dim your light. Look your best for men, but never show too much because they can't control themselves. Never fail, fall down, or quit. If you do, everyone will be disappointed. Be the leader, but always listen to what your peers tell you. Stand up tall and be confident, but don't act too confident or everyone says you're cocky. Shackles hold your hands and feet to the ground so you never learn to fly. Because flying shows you you can escape to a better life. But no, you can't have that better life without sacrificing your beliefs. Men's eyes examine your body as you walk through the grocery store. Aisle 13, potato chips, popcorn, the man who followed you over from aisle 6. Girls analyzing your face so they can tell their friends about your new zit. Everyone looks at you like you're a doll. Everyone has an opinion about you. Everyone has something to say. You want to speak up, but society tells you you're too loud. Mothers teach their daughters to yell mom instead of help. Fathers yelling and hurting their daughters over an outfit. Uncles saying, wow, look how much you've grown up, as they look down your blouse. Young women portrayed as dogs, always wanting attention from the closest person. Everything is always our fault, our problem to solve, always a victim. It's not true. We are strong. We are powerful. We are doctors. We are soldiers. We are powerful. We are told we won't ever amount to a man. We won't succeed in life without a man. You can't do it. You're only a woman. You're too skinny. You're too fat. You're too pale. You should wear more makeup. But why? Why do we live in a world like this? I may never know, but what I do know is I am strong, I am successful, I am a woman. We can do anything as long as we never, not even for a second, give up on what we want this life to be. I see everything I am and decide I am beautiful. Together, women must rise from the ashes of their struggles, their hearts intertwined, our souls mending the shattered pieces of another. A silent testimony to the power of sisterhood.
Our third place winner, Miriam Sofyan,
loves learning so much that she has done it at top speed. She finished high school in half the time in order to join our campus community this year at, we have another 16-year-old. At only 16, she's already in her second semester as a full-time college student. She's actually taking 3 English classes this semester, so perhaps it's not all that surprising that she was excited to submit her poetry to the Barrett Creative Writing Contest. While college is her focus now, she hopes to travel and study internationally when she completes her degree at HFC and to continue teaching, she's 16, continue teaching women of all ages in her community wherever she lands. Miriam's love of languages and translation also played a part in her writing. 2 of her 4 poems first came to her in Arabic. Translating poetry always poses a special challenge. Preserving tone, imagery, and rhythms in 2 very different languages is a daunting task. Miriam will be sharing 2 of her 4 poems today, A Step I Cannot Retrace and Sorrowful Depart. One of them you'll hear in Arabic first, then in English. Even if you don't speak or understand both languages, listen for the sounds and pacing and how the 2 versions speak to one another. The inspiration for these poems comes from about 1,500 years ago, from the works often referred to colloquially as Majnun Layla, or Layla's Madman. Miriam will give a bit more context herself, but something I learned about these poems from the 600s is that they're quite likely the original source text for the motif of the star-crossed, unrequited love that has fueled universally known texts that range from Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet all the way to whatever sad love song you just streamed this morning. It's hard to imagine a time when these ideas were brand new, but every archetype, every cliche, every literary trope was at one point brand new and revolutionary. The twist Miriam has put on her take has to do with perspective. The original poems were written from the male point of view, as he chastely loves Layla from afar. She is, of course, betrothed to another, and he slowly wastes away, basically. So sad. But what does Layla feel? The historical poems don't tell us, but Miriam does. Across the series of poems, as the speaker in those poems moves closer to her marriage, to, you know, the other, readers wonder if she will be able to forget her first true love. I'm not going to tell you, but Miriam will. Miriam.
Hello, everyone. My name is Miriam. And the 2 poems I wrote, one is in Arabic, so it's about Layla. As she said, the author, Qais ibn Mlawah, also known as Majnun Layla, he had this immense love for Layla, and he wrote dozens of poems about her. But how do we know what Layla feels? Well, judging from this story and from her perspective, I tried to write a poem. Obviously, I don't know how she felt, but I tried my best to write a poem on her perspective and how she feels. Okay, I'll start the one in Arabic, but I'll translate it to English because I have it written. Okay, sorrowful depart. سأرحل عنك وقلبي معك وأدفن حبا ما جناه سواك ولو أن للعمر ضربا آخر لسلكته إليك ولما تركت قدري يمضي دونك ولو طال شوقي وحزني عليك فلم أنم ليلا ولا نهارا والأكل يغيب عنه اللذة وكأن حبي فيك جنانا أحملك في نبضي أينما ذهبت كأنك وطني الذي لا يغيب أرى طيفك بين يقظتي وأحلامي فأمضي ولا أمضي أسير بلا طريق تسألني الأيام عنك فأخفض رأسي وأصمت كيف أخبرهم أنك رحلت لكنك ما زلت تسكنني قد أفارقك في الحياة لكن قلبي لم يعرف الفراق ولو كان للروح أن تختار مستقرها لاختارتك موطنا وعناق. Now the English version for this poem, Sorrowful Depart. I will leave you, yet my heart remains with you, burying a love only you have known. And if life had another path, I would have taken it to you, never letting fate move forward without you. And if my longing and sorrow for you stretch on, I would find no rest, neither in night nor day. Food loses its taste, as if my love for you is madness itself. I carry you in my pulse wherever I go, as if you are my homeland that never fades. I see your shadow between wakefulness and dreams, moving yet unmoving, a traveler with no path. The days ask me about you, and I lower my head in silence. How do I tell them you have left, yet you still live within me? I may part from you in life, but my heart has never known separation And if the soul could choose its resting place, it would choose you, a home and embrace. Okay, now the second poem, it's after she got married, like her wedding. A step I cannot retrace. And again, my family gathers for a wedding. Voices bright, joy too great to contain. I would have been excited too, if only the bride walking forward was it me. Unexpected guests, faces glowing. Smiles bloom across the room like scattered petals. The scent of oud lingers in the air, thick as a silence pressing against my chest. Gold embroidery glides beneath my fingertips, woven softer than my fate. The mirror watches with unfamiliar eyes, a bride wrapped in silk, framed in expectation. Kohel lines my gaze, dark and steady, but it does not hide what lingers beneath. Woman's whispers brush against my skin, doubting every step I take with heed. I start to think, was this what I wanted? Each step holds an unforgettable memory. It feels so quiet, but it sounds so loud. Now I know what it's like to be the bride. Thank you.
Hi, I'm John Reitz, also an English instructor, and I'm going to be introducing Alana DiMaggio. Our second place winner, Alana DiMaggio, also won second place in last year's Barrett Awards, and we're lucky to have her back. She's been writing for the HFC Mirror newspaper since last year and is currently the news editor, so you probably have read her work there as well. But she'll graduate in May, and after studying at Wayne State, she plans to pursue a career in the noble field of journalism, perhaps with a focus on nature and the environment. I'm especially happy to be introducing Alana's poems because I think so highly of them, even more so after having studied them in more detail. But even on the first reading, I was struck with the redness of her poem called Girlhood. Cherry popsicles, cherry lip gloss, red fingernails, the red heat of a July afternoon, and red lips caught between the candy of childhood and the sexuality of adolescence, which she captures in the memory of, quote, red pop and first kisses. That tension is echoed when she, quote, stands on the diving board, peering over the edge of childhood, heart hammering, close quote, with fear and excitement before the heat of youth is plunged into the cool aquamarine water of more temperate adulthood. The nostalgic tone of the poem is established abruptly when the title, Childhood, jumps to the poem's first word, was. The little girl, quote, wishes to grow up, but I think that most of us feel the nostalgic pull of intense childhood emotion. Her other poem, When Spring Comes, really speaks to me because, well, duh, who doesn't love spring? Unlike Girlhood, this is a poem of anticipation rather than retrospect, set up by the repeated pattern of, when this, I will that. This poem reminds me of another nature-loving poet, Gerard Manley Hopkins, whose lines can almost overwhelm the reader with their dense sound patterns and tumble of imagery. The alliteration of the line, when the warm weather wobbles in, is followed by the perfect image metaphor of like a newborn fawn. She finds verbs that do double duty, appealing to both auditory and tactile senses, when the grass swishes and sloshes under her feet. The newness of spring is seen in a catalog of images like the sunrise, the morning rain, the newborn fawn, the planting of a garden, the fallen petals like fresh snow, and the bunnies emerging from their burrows. There's always got to be bunnies in the spring. The final couplet puts the speaker's present wintertime experience of weary bones, suggesting death, up against the promise of rebirth in spring when, quote, I will be brand new again. Just as Girlhood begins with the word was, which firmly establishes that it is about a lost time, this poem ends with the word again, promising an annual renewal. I will be brand new again. What could be more timely? As you can tell, I'm really impressed with Alana's work, and I'm sure you will be too. Alana?
Hi, I'm Alana DiMaggio. This is When Spring Comes. When Demeter welcomes Persephone home with open arms, the sunrises will taste like blood orange and strawberry lemonade. When the grass squishes and sloshes with morning rain and worms inch their way onto the sidewalk, I will wiggle my bare toes in the mud. When the warm weather wobbles in like a newborn fawn, I will plant tomatoes in the garden and scrub the soil from my fingernails in the kitchen sink. When the petals fall from the trees and cover the street like fresh snow, I will pick them from your brown curls. When spring comes and the bunnies come out of their burrows to play in the wildflowers, winter's ache will leave my weary bones and I will be brand new again. And this one's called Girlhood. Girlhood was walking barefoot to the corner store, cherry popsicles melting down our arms, staining our denim shorts and our mouths, hot, sticky, and bright red. Sharing a tube of cherry lip gloss and giggling at the high school boys who honk at us from their pickup trucks, hanging out of the windows like dogs, drooling and panting. The burning July sun, long hair sticking to our tan skin. It was the summer before seventh grade, fresh and free, like a wild foal running through a field, learning to control growing limbs and growing bodies. The summer of truth or dare and gossip. Rap music playing from my headphones in the car, poems scrawled in purple ink. Red fingernails tying bikini tops tight and big sunglasses tangled in flat ironed hair. Only putting our feet in instead of swimming like mermaids across the pool. I stand on the diving board, peering over the edge of childhood, heart hammering. Wishing to grow up, I jump and let the aquamarine wash over me. I carry that summer inside my chest, cracking it open. It tastes like red pop and first kisses. Was I a girl or a woman? Maybe I was both. Maybe I still am. Sometimes when I catch a glimpse of my reflection, I see girlhood.
Good afternoon. I'm Peter Kim, also an English instructor. I have the honor of introducing this year's first place winner. Having won first place last year, this is a familiar place for Elena Schnell. And like last year, Elena has also won the Larry Coulter Poetry Prize. This year, Elena won for both a poem and a short story. Her story, Hunger Pangs, she says, was inspired by her memories of food exploring physical hunger sensations with a metaphorical hunger for valuable human connection. The story has an amazing effect of making one both starved and hungry at once. With images that are absurdly grotesque, you'll know what I mean when you hear it, in one moment and sensuous in the next. Elena's poem, For You, Ada, was written for her creative writing class with my dear colleague, Professor Ruth Ann Schmidt. The assignment was to write about an original character. Elena says she wrote about a young woman in the 1970s who was heavily involved in the politics and social issues of the era, such as second wave feminism. While this may have been the original image, the poem goes well beyond to evoke universal themes of longing and regret that are prescient for our current state of affairs. Again, you'll know what I'm talking about when you hear it. Elena currently serves as the creative editor for the Mirror News. I happen to be the advisor, so. This month, she won two statewide journalism awards. Even after she graduates HFC, Elena hopes to continue developing her skills as a journalist, like her colleague, Alana. Possibly working for a magazine or doing freelance work. Elena plans to transfer to the University of Michigan Ann Arbor, majoring in English with concentrations in creative writing and literature. Her path to U of M has already started, having received a community college summer fellowship starting this May. While I could keep going on with her amazing accomplishments and bright future in so many different areas, today let us enjoy Elena's remarkable skills as a writer as she reads from her award-winning entries. Welcome, Elena Schnell.
Thank you, Dr. Kim. So I will first be reading my poem for you, Ada. She swaggers into the bowling alley every Friday night, flared bell-bottom blue jeans draped over her washed-out pink Converse. Her hair was so loud, it rang through the empty bellies of every bowling ball, its pinks and grays and purples and blues, escape shape as it rattled melodically with violence. Oh yeah, she was real cool, but unlike Gwendolyn Brooks, too scared to skip school. so she rebelled by sticking Newports between her plush, blood-pigmented lips and swiping vodka from her mother's mahogany liquor cabinet. Her mind, a rubber-banded ball of wit, even the cacophony of sounds that bounced off her tongue carried a spunk. A spitfire, they called her, naive and drunk on optimism, too. For she believed she alone could massage the minds of the masses, pumping them with news of an upcoming second wave of women who would march with their mother's rage to Washington. She killed the sensations felt from pinching her index finger by rubbing a pencil against it for 8 years. And she wrote and wrote. But her articles must have been clumsy and juvenile and deemed too lousy to be archived, because she exited the 70s without a mark of her youth. And she, Ada, recites these stories to herself with fried lungs and flat words, unaware she is entrapped in skin that sags like a gallon of milk in a plastic bag and inhabits a cluttered apartment, lined paper stuck to the wooden floor and loaded with cursive passion. And she writes and writes. And this one is my short story, Hunger Pains. I remember wiping down countertops on a Sunday morning because the restaurant was slow, at least until the Baptist board and after Mass. So there was nothing else better to do than slowly drag a rag across the counter like a droopy rag doll and hold my breath because I smelt like roasted chicken and my sleeves were soaked in sweat. The night before, I rinsed dirt out of my hair, and 2 weeks before that, we failed a health inspection. Jobs were on the line, she warned. It was summer, and I dreamt of having friends I could speed on the highway with past curfew and smoke pot with till we vomit, the orange chunks strolling down our chins and staining our lace tank tops. I would smell like raspberries and smile more. I would be important. But I was without a driver's license, no cash to buy decent pot, the smell of grime and grease stuck to my skin, and why would I smile if there was no one to do it with? My coworker interrupted this fantasy, placing his dark, calloused hand on my shoulder and called me Lane, stating my full name is 3 syllables too long. You're cute, he smiled coyly. I nodded in agreement and shrugged his fat hand off my shoulder. He walked away with a swagger, letting out a soft chuckle. He must have forgotten that I was 17 and that he was 17, 20 years before me. Or maybe that he had a sad and unbathed girlfriend waiting at home, binge-watching TLC and chugging liquor. At least that's how I imagined her to be. Or maybe his chubby-cheeked little girl, whom he pinned a school picture of to the corkboard between chicken scratch complaints, chicken is too salty and mac and cheese frozen. There wasn't much time to think because the Baptist filed in, yelling over the guitar riffs on the radio, dark chicken, white chicken, 2 ketchup packets, no, make it 3, hold the cornbread, it tasted dry last time. You expect me to pay $45 for a 16-piece? A portly, clean-looking man approached the counter and asked me if I thought I was a good person. I was flirting with moral nihilism at this time and was tempted to say, there is no such person. But I wasn't paid to philosophize, and besides, he would have agreed, confusing me for a Christian. Yes, I replied. He shook his head in disappointment, like I was his daughter whom he just found with a strange boy. He handed me a pamphlet and repeated the question. The pages contained poorly drawn cartoon characters indulging in the 7 deadly sins. One of them, a young man, I believe, was lusting over a blonde prostitute with big breasts walking by on the sidewalk, his chin wet with drool. Yes, I said, returning the pamphlet. People sat in me, I thought, often leaving me with hunger pangs, only feeding me empty calories. Even my first love, my daddy, dad, father, a man. He drove me and my brother to Coney Island in his white Mustang. The sunroof was down, and it was warm. The wind whipped thin hair strands in my face. We arrived, and I forgot what I ordered. It didn't matter. My lungs began to close in, my body trembling. I excused myself, sliding out of the booth into the bathroom. I hid behind a red, sparkly stall door and worked up hot tears. I had admitted to myself that my father was a bad man who loved me and my brother so much that he proclaimed there was no one else worth his love. Everyone else was at the brunt of his drunken mood swings, flattened by his words and trapped by his charm. His love was so immense that he must have felt gluttonous,
as his cravings for kisses, cuddles, and cram-written birthday cards diminished. But who else was there to feed me? I splashed water on my face till it turned to its pasty complexion. Returning to the booth, I watched as my father devoured his cheeseburger and made faces, showing off the bits of beef between the root of his teeth and his gums. In a state of discomfort, we laughed, clapping our baby hands together till they burned. I don't recall ever picking up my fork. When I was 13, I lived with my great aunt and uncle because the state of Michigan ripped me from my mother's grasp without warning and kept me out until they realized they had made an embarrassing mistake and sent me back home with two tubs of vanilla ice cream to share with Mom, a tasty apology. My aunt had long, string legs like me, so we walked 6 miles through the side streets of Dearborn to Tim Hortons in a breeze. I ordered a frozen hot chocolate, and I believe she ordered a pink lemonade or something equal and vibrant in youth. On our walk back, I took the lid off to lick the whipped cream, some of it going up my nostrils, and stuck a fat pink straw into the center, sucking up the sugary treat as though it bottled my tears. My stomach eased, and I forgot who I was. "There is no scheduled court date yet," she shared. "Okay," I said, because what else was there to say? No one was sure how long I was to be here. At night, I'd often lay on my side, silently weeping into the pillow till I'd lost my breath, and then carry their Russian blue cat, Nala, into my room, slowly dragging my nails across her striped fur, thinking. Other times, such unpredictability excited me. At least my life was not dull. "Well," I said, grinning, "we may have many more Tim Hortons trips." She studied me momentarily with tired eyes. "Sure," she smiled. A bird flew overhead, weaving its way in front of the sun. Moments later, I felt a cool goo splatter on my sweaty head. My aunt erupted into laughter, and I followed suit. We hurried back to Tim Hortons and grabbed a handful of napkins, dabbling each lump of poo. She spoke of a generational curse. All women in our family have terrible luck with birds. Each of us has been pooped on several times. Rather than the first time blood poured out of my vagina, a half-drunken Tim Hortons cup and bird poop on my head felt like my inauguration into womanhood. Or maybe it was early elementary when there were 3 neatly stacked hotcakes lathered in watery sugar and Lando Lakes in front of me, the pan still hovering over a circle of blue flames. As my grandmother was flipping in her bubblegum-colored robe that I never understood why she wore, it had an itchy exterior like a bath towel. Each bite was savored as the cake fluff hugged my mouth and rested for a moment so the syrup would tickle my taste buds and soak through the outermost layer of my tongue. Pausing, I turned to my grandmother and giggled as she was mixing what was left of the batter. "You have to put your butt into it," she smiled, shaking hers to strengthen her way through the thick batter. Her mother told her that I had seen my mother do the same, so now I refused to buy an electric hand whisk because I too know how to work my body until a task is complete. "Why can't you just complete the fucking turn?" he bitched at the gray Honda in front of us, also turning out of the Kroger's parking lot. Below the silver boxed-in H on the car's rear was a plate that read in small curved emerald text, myflorida.com. There were 2 white speckled oranges with lovely orange blossoms blooming out of the centermost one. The plate proudly declared being the Sunshine State. "The Sunshine State," I mused. "Why they are in Michigan in the dead of winter is beyond me," he said. Hicks, I thought, being surrounded by ungroomed, obese men supporting MAGA hats with an "I voted for the outlaw and hillbilly" lawn posters with Trump and Vance back to back in rocking shades in front of the American flag ought to make anyone dizzy. We returned to my brown-bricked bungalow, carrying bags filled with pork sausage, whipped cream, baking powder, flour, and a half gallon of milk. It takes roughly an hour to make biscuits and gravy, at least following his family's recipe. I worked my small palms into the dough, spreading it thinly and folding it hot dog style. I repeated this process 5 times until the dough felt meaty with layers. I then pressed a glass cup into the dough, making a dozen cutouts, ready to be baked for approximately 15 minutes. I was hungry and in love. Cannibalism is perhaps my favorite metaphor in literature. I was ravenous, insatiable, wanting to tear into the salty flesh of my lover and treat the open wounds. I wanted the hot gravy to burn my throat and bloat my belly. I read an excerpt from Eileen Myers' poem Peanut Butter to him. I am always hungry and wanting to have sex. This is a fact. He appeared puzzled, dramatically raising his thick brow. I continued, selecting another excerpt. Parts of your body I think of as stripes, which I have learned to love along. We swim naked in ponds, and I write behind your back. I think I understand, he said. The oven timer alarm began to blare, and he rushed over with gray cloth mittens with dainty white roses near their sleeves. We ate in my bedroom, the one I've had since childhood. We need to make more gravy next time, I said, and he quietly nodded in agreement. Nonetheless, I was pleased. The biscuits were fluffy, and the gravy burned my throat and sizzled, almost hissed, at the bottom of my stomach before resting. I recognized how full I felt, oozing with ecstasy and bloody passion. He let out a low belch and giggled in embarrassment. Yes, I understand, he smiled. I think I love you. That's all. Thank you.
That was awesome. Another round of applause for all of our winners and our runners. Again, thank you so much for coming.
Listener supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
WHFR celebrates Free Comic Book Day on Saturday, May 3rd at Green Brain Comics. In addition to a special selection of free comics available on Free Comic Book Day, you can pick up some free WHFR swag and maybe even meet a few of your favorite WHFR on-air personalities. Stop by Green Brain Comics on Saturday, May 3rd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and visit the WHFR tent, just one of the many special guests and activities going on at Green Brain Comics Free Comic Book Day. More info at greenbraincomics.com and WHFR.fm.
And WHFR Dearborn, Highway 61. I'm DJ Kitty Love here with you for 4 hours on a station making waves, WHFR.fm. Show's called Highway 61, and I bring you blues and some Detroit blues and a calendar. And I do believe we are going to hear a song.